Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench. Hello and welcome back to Fighting on Film. This is the very first episode, regular episode, of the show in 2024. So
yeah,
happy
we're
new
back.
Year if you're joining us. And of course, I mentioned regular there. We are doing a side series at the moment encompassing the brand new Masters of the Air show over on Apple TV. So if you haven't checked out those shows yet, definitely have a listen.
Well, it's hot on the heels of this one. So maybe by the time, if you're listening on day of recording, they won't be out yet. But maybe if you're listening a few days later, then definitely go and check them out.
If you haven't already, do so. Calendars are hard for me.
A little bit behind the scenes, Matt's off to Vegas literally hours after we record this episode. So his mind may be elsewhere. But
off to work.
For this hour, yeah. That's a long commute.
Yeah. So this week, we are covering the Green Berets. We wanted to start off the new year with one of those movies that we've been meaning to do and is culturally important. Many people hate it. It's a very interesting movie in and of itself. It's not a good movie, and we'll discuss that in detail.
Right out the bat. Like, yeah. You're not beating around the bush this week, are you, mate?
No, and John Wayne knew it wasn't the best thing he'd ever done. He just felt passionate that he had to do it. And that's what makes the film really interesting.
Yeah.
So, released in 1968, it is not the first, but the second, we think, Vietnam War movie.
Possibly third.
Oof.
Yeah.
More research on that is needed. But it's the first major studio picture, I would argue.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Released on Warner Brothers 7 Arts in June 1968. Of course, John Wayne directed, also starred, and it's an adaptation of a book which was written by a chap called Robin Moore. And he'd been a writer for some time, and he'd actually gone to the trouble of doing the Q selection course for the Green Berets, which is a big deal. He was the first civilian to actually pass the Q course. He'd been in the US Army Air Force in World War II. But this was his breakout book. It was a bestseller. It was also obviously, it came out in 1965. So it was around that time where the US public were really interested in what was going on in Vietnam. And a number of studios vied for it early on. And then they kind of lost interest because they weren't sure if a Vietnam movie was going to be something that the public was interested in. So the rights were sort of lapsed, and John Wayne came in and bought them for $50,000.
Wow. A lot of money back then.
A lot of money.
Well, not for old John Wayne, though. He's probably chump change at that point in his career, but, you know.
Yeah. And he took it to a number of studios, and finally Warner Brothers said yes. With the caveat, however, that he co-direct. So
okay.
In 1960, John Wayne had directed The Alamo, which was his big passion piece. It was an epic.
Yeah.
And it didn't do great.
Academy Award nom for John Wayne, though, in that.
Yep. It didn't do what the studio wanted.
No.
And it kind of stalled his directorial career. Yeah.
Ironically, the Disney version didn't do what Disney wanted in 2004. No,
they're both really interesting films. And the Disney films become one of those ones that's like, it's cult for being one of the biggest
financial bomb
of the modern era. But it's actually a pretty good film.
It's decent. Yeah.
You know, we'll cover it at some point. What Warner actually did was they said, you've got to have a co-director to kind of like help out. So John Wayne actually chose somebody he worked with in the past, a chap called Ray Kellogg. He was a former member of the OSS Field Photography branch and knew John Ford. So he has a really interesting career.
Yeah.
Where he directs a couple of small budget B-movie type things.
Yeah.
The late 50s, early 60s. And then what he's best known for is he's a really skilled second unit director.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows how to shoot action. Mm-hmm. And he worked on Stagecoach, Castle Keep, ooh, and Tora 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 as well. So he's had an interesting career. But on top of that, there was another director who isn't listed or credited, called Mervyn LeRoy, and he served as sort of an assistant advisor on the film for about 5 to 6 months. And essentially Warners were concerned that Wayne, even with Kellogg, wouldn't be able to carry a picture this big. It's a lot of budget, a lot to go wrong. It's touchy subject matter. So they kind of just hired LeRoy.
Mm.
And he said of it later on, I took over and assisted the Duke with the directing whenever he needed me. I didn't do it for nothing, of course, but I wouldn't let them put my name on it, as I didn't think that would be fair to the Duke, which I thought was interesting quote.
Mm.
And he worked on a couple of war movies prior to this. He worked on Waterloo Bridge, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, and Escape. So he has an interesting career as well. And the way I think it worked out was Kellogg oversaw the action sequences, which is about like a third of the actual film.
Pretty much.
And then LeRoy handled the scenes that Wayne was in, and then Wayne directed all the scenes that he wasn't in. So I think that's kind of like how it worked.
Him being billed as director is a complete hogwash.
Yeah. And when you consider it like that, the film is a lot more cohesive than you would kind of imagine.
Yeah, but then that kind of explains why I feel like it doesn't feel cohesive in some aspects.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
That explains a lot.
So the actual screenplay was adapted by James Lee Barrett, who was a Korean War vet, and he'd worked on The Greatest Story Ever Told, Shenandoah, The Undefeated, and April Morning, which is a film about the battles of Lexington and Concord that I want to cover this year in April, which I think will be on time to do it.
Be a good one.
And that pretty much rounds out the production side of things. Although, of course, one thing I managed to dig up was that the Department of Defense attached a special forces advisor. So there was a lot of support from the DOD, as you would imagine, much like those World War II movies, you know, the classics. And they attached a Major Gerald R. Dodds, and he was a three-tour Vietnam veteran, did three tours in Vietnam. Blimey. Silver Star, Bronze Star, well,
three
Legion
tours
of
in 67 when they shot.
Yeah. So he was in from 55 to 75 and
Did
three tours throughout his time. I couldn't track down exactly when he was in country, but Silver Star, Bronze Star, Legion of Merit, Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with two palms. So he knew what he was doing.
You made the film about him.
Yeah, that would have been great, wouldn't it?
Would have been better.
Yeah.
Right. Do you have a budget this week?
Budget, $7 million.
Wow. A lot. A
couple of interesting things around that, though. Apparently, there was some criticism of how much the Defense Department charged for using their infrastructure and personnel, etc.
Sure.
They only charged Batjack Productions, which was John Wayne's production company, $18,623.
Blimey. Bargain.
Yeah. Whereas the actual costs to the US Army were closer to about $1 million.
Oh, okay. So someone somewhere is like, this could be good for our image.
Exactly. Yeah. And a Democrat representative called Benjamin Rosenthal revealed the figure in 1969 and accused the film of being Pentagon propaganda, essentially. Whoa. Which it kind of
They're not wrong. They're not wrong, as we will explore later on, for sure.
So I think cast.
Yeah, cast and the return of the one-word review and the return of the retro reviews coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So cast.
The retro reviews this week are going to be off the chain.
They weren't kind, shall we say. So, for cast, of course, we have John Wayne, the Duke himself, playing Colonel Mike Kirby. He's obviously the legendary actor of Hollywood's golden age. We covered Sands of Iwo Jima before Christmas last year. Obviously, Matt has already mentioned The Alamo. He appears in True Grit, which he gets an Academy Award win in 1969. Fort Apache, The Fighting Sea Beast, They Were Expendable, Flying Tigers, The Longest Day, Brannigan, just on the top of my head. Everyone knows who John Wayne is, I think, by now. You know, I'm not going to mansplain Wayne. So we have up next, we have Aldo Ray playing Sergeant Muldoon. He was a US Navy frogman in the Second World War. He saw action at Okinawa. In his terms of war movie credits, there's Battle Cry, Three Stripes of the Sun, What Did You Do in the War, Daddy, Suicide Commandos, and an appearance in the original SWAT 70s TV series, which is interesting. Then we have David Janssen playing George Beckworth, the correspondent. He was Richard Kimball in The Fugitive and was in To Hell and Back and Hell to Eternity. So, yeah, massive TV pull back in the day.
With The Fugitive, massive.
Yeah, really is. Then we have Jim Hutton as Sergeant Peterson, and he starred in 40 US Army training films whilst in the US Army in the late 1950s, early 60s. It's really interesting. Yeah. And he appeared, then he kind of during that time, he did appear in some TV projects. So he appeared in the short-lived Second World War drama The Big Attack in 1956, which is like a sort of proto-combat kind of esque series. There's not a lot about it online, but I think it is all on YouTube. And then he's in The Horizontal Lieutenant, which is like a light-hearted sort of comedy, romantic army film. Then you have, he's in Major Dundee and The Hallelujah Trail. They're both westerns. Then we have Raymond St. Jakes as Sergeant Doc McGee. Green Berets is his only war credit, but he did play Martin Luther King in Private Files of J. Edgar Hoover. And he played
Rawhide as well.
Yep, Simon Blake in the 8th season of Rawhide. And he was also in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. So another, you know, he would have been recognisable to audiences in America. And then we have a really big hitter in George Takei as Captain Nim, one of the South Vietnamese soldiers who assists the Green Berets in the movie. Now, of course, you know, we all know George Takei, Star Trek fan or not, for playing Sulu in the original series. And interestingly enough, the shoot ran over and it almost lost him his role in Star Trek. So he's not in season two for a lot of the episodes because of this one.
I never knew that. I never knew there was a reason. Oh, cool.
Yeah, Matt's our resident Trekkie.
Yeah.
I'm so pleased to first handing some Star Trek facts to him this week. So he also had some other war movie credits. He was in PT-109 and he was in Which Way to the Front? And he also commented this about his casting on the film in 1967 and why Wayne chose to cast him. So he said, there was a core decency in him. He was a very pro-war guy. And when I went in for the interview, he says, I have to be honest with you. I don't agree with you. Sorry, when I went in for the interview, I said, I have to be honest with you. I don't agree with you about the war in Vietnam. I have been campaigning against the war. I wanted you to know. He surprised me. He said, I'm hiring the best actor I can for the role, and that's all I'm concerned about. Fellow actors, Hutton and Janssen, are also pro-peace, and I'm casting them, so I'm making my decision based on acting ability.
Wow.
Yeah. But then apparently Wayne on set kept referring to him as Sulu. So if he wanted him, he'd go, you know, find me Sulu, where's Sulu? Get him for me. So there's even a theory that Wayne was a secret Trek fan, and that's why he cast him. But we might never know. It was a cultural phenomenon back in the 60s, wasn't it? So,
yeah.
You know, it's you know, I'm a TNG guy. I'm a Next Generation guy.
Yeah, Rob's working his way in.
I am, yeah. Loving it so far. And then we have Jack Sue as Colonel Kai. He's best known for his role in the sitcom Barney Miller, but he also appeared in MASH and Hawaii Five-O and lots of other American TV credits. Then we have Patrick Wayne, the son of John Wayne. No points for guessing that one, as Lieutenant Jameson. He was in The Searchers, The Alamo, The Gatling Gun, Big Jake, Young Guns in the 90s. He starred in 11 of John Wayne's movies. So don't let me hear you say Nepo babies are a new thing, because they're not. Then we have Craig Dew as Hamchuck, and he has very few credits to his name. He later appears in MASH, Lancer, which is a TV drama, and a couple of episodes of The Bill Cosby Show in the 70s. Yeah, that one's aged like milk, isn't it? Then we have Irene Sue as Lynn. She's a prolific, you know, American TV, some film roles. She's in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., The Horizontal Lieutenant again, Airport 1975, and there's one for Matt. She was also in Paper Tiger.
Oh, was she? Oh, cool.
Yeah. So then that's pretty much the cast. I mean, that's all the main players. There's a few other sort of ancillary characters, but, you know, it mainly you're with Wayne and the main beret boss all the way through. Everyone else is kind of ancillary.
It's notable for the fact that it cast zero Vietnamese actors. They're all either Japanese-Americans or Chinese-Americans or Chinese.
That's true. Korean descent, yeah.
Yeah, and if you pause on some of the combat sequences and the VC, there's a lot of white guys in there.
Well, they're just guys off the lot, aren't they?
Yeah,
you know, well, that's what it feels like.
It's also theorized that they're troops that were hired on as well.
That would make complete sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? Yeah. And then they'd have full control over what they did. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. So then we have the one word reviews, which are back. And it was an amazing response on the Twitter or the X profile. We had 104 replies, and I'm going to pick some at random.
And Rob's going to read them all.
So we have Eddie Bond goes with propaganda. Propaganda. Jem Dudaku goes bollocks. My cats are fighting outside. I hope that doesn't come through on the recording. If it does, I'll leave it in. Brian Williams says polarized. Bill 1940 medal campaign goes with pish. Kevin Getz, bath. Ian McClellan, drivel. Very Frank, awful. The sophisticated review goes with skyhook. Randy S. Robbins goes with Viet crap, which I quite enjoyed. JL says whitewash. Russell Hogg, tosh. Edward Demanouf, crap. Craig Seaton goes with Hamchuck. Harold Ellis says patriotic. And Mark Denton will end it this week, and he said jingoistic. But there was across the board, like, just
there was a couple of them. I did see one or two that were that said misunderstood.
To a point, I agree. Yeah. To a point.
Yeah, but there are differing opinions.
Yeah,
that's what I mean.
Definitely, but it was a bumper response. We're so pleased that everyone was, you know, in the wings waiting for the one word reviews to come back. So we love reading them out. So on to the first retro review of 2024, and who better to join us from the annals of film critique past than the legend Roger Ebert? So we have a review from him. From June 26, 1968, and I'll read you a couple of excerpts. So he says, "The Green Berets simply will not do as a film about the war in Vietnam. It is offensive not only to those who oppose American policy, but even to those who support it. At this moment in our history, locked in the longest and one of the most controversial wars we have ever fought, what we certainly do not need is a movie depicting Vietnam in terms of cowboys and Indians. That is cruel and dishonest and unworthy of thousands who have died there. If I was a soldier in Vietnam, I would not want to be represented by the Green Berets. I would not want any of my fellow citizens to think I was as stupid and simple-minded as the Americans in this film. I would prefer a much more realistic film in which I was seen not as a hero, but as an individual human trying to act ethically in a difficult position.
Give it 10, 15 years, Roger. You'll get it.
You'll get a glove.
You'll get your wish. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. and to jump off of the retro review this week, because a lot of the reviews at the time were scathing.
Oh, the New York Times one goes in.
Oh, it really goes in hard, doesn't it? But commercially, the movie does make a profit. It makes quite a big profit.
Yeah, 32 million.
Yeah, which I think is interesting. And I think that's maybe just the pull of John Wayne, other than anything else.
Well, it was
in
the top 10 movies of the year. Mm. Wayne himself thought that perhaps the harsh criticism drove audiences to go and see it.
Quite possibly, yeah. That always happens,
that was
doesn't
one
it?
Thing he theorized.
Mm.
But it wasn't just in America that it was hated. I did some reading around, and apparently in West Germany, it was compared to Nazi propaganda.
Wow.
It was compared to a couple of the wartime propaganda movies.
Mm.
And it was criticized as an oversimplification of the issues. It was described as naive portrayal.
I think it's all fair. It's all fair critique.
It was noted for its, you know, very prominent, strong militarism. So much so that Wayne eventually published a statement in the LA Times in January 68, in which he said that he wasn't debating whether it was right or wrong for the United States to be in this war. We are showing the mettle of American fighting men.
Wow. Hit and miss there, John. Swing and a miss there, boy. I've got it down here. I think it's really interesting that this film comes out post-Tet Offensive, 1968, and post-Battle for Hue in June of that year.
Yeah.
Sorry, Hue was earlier. And public opinion massively changes after Hue. You know, because the Tet and Hue were beamed right into to people's homes like that, like it hadn't been before.
Yeah,
advent of, you know, news television broadcasting, and just public opinion really shifts. And it must be said that there is a firm and pro-war movement in the States during the 60s. It's not as talked about as much as maybe I think it should be, because obviously the anti-war movement that comes after Tet is a lot bigger and noisier. But there is a little core of people that do believe the US is doing over there is just. And the figures for it are quite interesting. I couldn't find them. I've got them in a book somewhere, but I couldn't find it for the recording. But I find it's really interesting because, ironically, the Tet Offensive was a strategic win for the US and South Vietnam.
Mm.
Like, it did knock a blow to the Viet Cong and the PAVN.
It was a miscalculation for them, wasn't it?
Yeah, but because of the losses that the US suffered and the perceived bloodiness and brutalness of that campaign back home just sways opinion a lot. And I think this movie couldn't have picked, I mean, obviously wouldn't have known that Tet was going to happen. You know, no one knew it was going to happen. It was a surprise offensive by North Vietnam. But they couldn't have picked a worse time to release your jingoistic pro-war movie.
No,
right,
this is
after
it.
Tet.
This is it. So, I mean, coming off that, the production on the film starts in late 65. So Wayne actually writes to Lyndon B. Johnson, the president, and he says that he wants to write this movie. Michael Munn's biography, he's quoted as saying, "I told the president that I felt it was important for the people of the United States and also the people all over the world should be shown why it was necessary for Americans to be in Vietnam. And I got the government support to make the picture." So in the summer of 66, he then goes to Vietnam, and he spends a couple of days in Saigon, and then he goes to the front and he does a bit of USO stuff, tours around, has a look around. He's there about 3 weeks with Barrett, the screenwriter, and then they come back, work up the script, and get the film into production in, I believe it was mid 67.
Yes, yeah.
And then they work on it for about 6-8 months, probably just while Tet's, you know.
Yeah. I mean, on set, they must have been thinking, oh, God. You know, the studio must have been thinking, wow, this isn't going to go down very well. And obviously it doesn't. But I think maybe that we can side into the Alley Tally now and try and rescue some positives, because I think after the Alley Tally and after Favourite Scenes, I kind of don't have anything positive to say about this film.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
It's time for Ali Tally on Fighting on Film.
The first Ali Tally of 2024. I think I know what you're going to be talking about. I think everyone listening who's seen the Green Berets knows what you're going to be talking about right now.
Say the line, Matt. yeah, so we've got to talk about the Mattel M16, haven't we?
We do. Unfortunately, we have to.
And it's become infamous. And it's really interesting because there was a rumor that went around during the war, I believe, that some GIs thought that Mattel had been making parts for the M16. Because the M16 is a space-age lightweight weapon. It's aluminium alloys, polymers. It's, you know, it's unlike anything.
It's cutting edge when it's introduced in 65.
Before. Exactly. It's 63. People criticized it as being a bit toy-like. And of course, Mattel, in about 1966, released the Marauder, which is a toy based on the M16. And it has a big speaker which makes, you know, gunfire noises,
like a clack.
In the magazine. And that's the most identifiable kind of feature of it. So, of course, in production of the movie, they must have thought, well, there's a bit in the script where John Wayne gets really angry and breaks a rifle against a tree. What do they do? They go, oh, well, I know what we can do. We can substitute in a plastic toy. That'll be a lot easier for the Duke to smash against that tree. Because he'd have had a hell of a job trying to break a M16 apart, I think.
Not one of Eugene Stoner's greatest ever inventions. Like, he'd have been there for a while, you know.
So it actually appears in the film before that scene, which is towards the end of the film.
Oh, does it?
So if you remember the bit where the lieutenant, or the lieutenant, is killed by the mortar round during the night attack, if you look on the floor, there's a bent M16. And you can just see, I think, this is my theory at least, I believe it's a Mattel gun because it has the big, thick sort of
magazine. We'll definitely try and screenshot that for the Facebook, socials. Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, later on, there's the famous scene where John Wayne gets very upset that one of his men's died and he kind of just, like,
for such an iconic sort of infamous scene, it's become a little bit infamous because it's fed into this myth of the M16 not being a very good service weapon. Yeah. And people that know why, because that early batch were not good. They weren't a good batch of rifles. But by the time...
Troops weren't trained the ball propellant wasn't exactly what they had been tested with. Mm. It was a slightly cheaper form of propellant. It didn't perform as well in the field. No. The chaps weren't told they had to clean the weapons, and clean the weapons.
Jack Kirby, the Marvel comic book artist, drew a cleaning manual.
Yeah, he did,
for the M16 to help troops, like help these kids learn how to clean their weapon. You know, and I think it's this whole thing of, Matt, you'll probably agree that the M14 was held in such high regard that when they brought in this space age looking gun, I think the old sweats were like, "What the hell's this thing?"
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there was definitely an element of that. And then the early issues really coloured it for a lot of guys. And it's interesting because the myth kind of continues. There's you see a lot of comments on videos about LEM-16s from veterans, yep. And they'll swear down that their rifle had a Mattel handguard or had, yep, Mattel stamped on it. So much so, a colleague of mine, Logan Metish, who is a historian, he runs the High Caliber History YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah.
He did a great video where he addressed the myth, did a lot of research into the background of it and the origins, and then he actually made his own Mattel rifle. He took a blank lower receiver and put a Mattel had a laser engraved Mattel logo onto the receiver.
Oh my god, I dread to think how many times that photo has been used to legitimize the myth.
Oh no, he is the first to admit that the people have misappropriated his joke. But no, he did a great video on it. I definitely recommend checking it out. But the M16 in the film is actually XM16E1 with the bear cage, not sorry, with the three prong
flash hider.
With the three prong flash hider butt forward assist.
Yes.
Which by that point is a little bit older.
Yeah, I think so.
Had A1s coming in by
because I think they'd started using bird cages around that time. Mm.
So there's some interesting guns in there.
Some very interesting weapon chat there for everybody. We kind of, you know, dabbled. We rambled. Anyway, no, for me, I mean, I really like the one thing I think the movie gets well, and this is obviously from the US Department of Defense involvement, is I like the early mixture of early Vietnam War kit. Because the movie never, I don't think the movie ever expressively says when it's set, but it's clearly set in like 65, 66. It's clearly quite early.
You get that kind of vibe, which the three prong flash hiders would fit in. Mm. And I don't know whether you noticed, but a lot of the guys in Fort Benning, when it's supposed to be Fort Benning, they've got the subdued like rank flashes and stuff.
Yeah.
And then in Vietnam, when they get to Vietnam, a lot of the guys have the, you know, the original like non-subdued.
Yeah, subdued patches came in way later. They're like late 60s, you know, that in a direct response to being in theatre.
Yeah.
That's where they come from. So, yeah, the mixture of like early uniforms. So you have second pattern jungle fatigues, which you rarely see on camera. They're the essentially, you know, like the sort of American paratrooper looking jackets. But the way you can identify a second pattern jungle fatigue is it's got the buttons on the outside.
Right.
And for the third pattern, they put a like another piece of material over the buttons to stop them from being frayed and broken. So that's really nice to see. And they're all, you know, John Wayne's is all pressed and it looks fantastic. Like I it's really great. And then later on, they changed to tiger stripe uniforms, which is, you know, Vietnam War, you know, really famous camouflage. Mm-hmm. And I read that apparently that camo became really popular after the war. But I don't know whether they mean like as a fashion item or whether they mean with troops, because they can't mean with troops, because tiger stripe been being used by the South Vietnamese and North Vietnamese have been using their own made versions of it. That's where it comes from. It comes from Vietnam, that pattern of camo.
It must mean fashion-wise, I guess.
I assume so. I couldn't find any real bead on it. But it's and obviously that, you know, that camouflage becomes adopted by US advisors, MACV SOG teams, LERP teams, Navy SEALs all use it. It's a very iconic looking, you know, camouflage. Always love to see it. It's one of my favorites. Then I really enjoyed seeing M1 carbines in use by the Arvn troops. I think there's even a Garand in there, because to me, that's like, ooh, representation of Americans getting rid of all their old weapon stocks to the Montagnard and the South Vietnamese army that they did. And I've got another thing about weapons, but I'll save it for favorite scenes, because there's a reason why I really like that bit. The Spooky's cool to see with the miniguns.
Yeah,
the
Spooky's really cool. The Citroen DS escape car at the end.
It's so... Oh, God, the ending of the movie. So,
oh, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Oh, God. Yeah.
It's fascinating to me that, like, none of the VC or MVA have any of the classic Comblock weapons.
No, they don't, even though they show them at the start.
Yeah, and they're all equipped with everything from there's some of the guys are running around with M14s. They're equipped with everything from like M14s to old Mausers. Mm. And like
which
one
isn't
guy
wrong
has...
for MVA.
No, it's not. It's,
sorry, and, VC. Sorry, it's not wrong.
And the earlier in the war, the more likely that is, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, it's a misnomer that they were poorly equipped. They get a heck of a lot of gear from a heck of a lot of countries that's ferried in through North Vietnam.
It's the same for the Arvin and the Montagnards. Like, there's a lot of carbines, as you say, and then there's some Mausers, and I even think I spotted an SMLE at one point.
You may have done.
There is like one VC.
I like the Biao Gam Duck Hunter caps that Nguyen has.
They're
incredible.
Yeah, because George Takei arrives when he's introduced, he's wearing one, isn't he?
Yeah, he's got the peak other... turned up. Oh, I just love it. Just love it.
There's a weird 22 caliber T-62 like AR-7 that's been put in like a Tommy gun stock.
Oh, okay.
One of the VC has, because it's really prominent. Like, it climbs over a barbed wire fence and he kind of like throws it up in the air when he gets shot.
Yeah. They've just armed them with whatever's in the armory.
Really have.
Whatever's on the lot armory's been raided for that sequence.
And if it was done at Benning, like, they probably just pulled out anything they had for like
any old rubbish.
And reference and stuff.
It shows, and that in itself shows the contempt this movie has for its enemy force, that it hasn't even gone out of its way to arm them properly. You know, and yet you've got the Green Berets running around like they've literally just come out of a quartermaster's stores. They're so well equipped. Like,
I like the South Vietnamese colonel's suppressed Colt Woodsman.
That was cool.
That he uses at the end to drop a couple of centuries.
I did like that. Yeah. In terms of its kit and representation, it isn't shocking. I'll give it that.
No,
obviously, it's got that Department of Defense help, so I wasn't expecting it to be awful.
Aldo Ray runs around with an M79, but doesn't use it.
Never uses it, no. There's some nice mortar action in it. It's not fantastic, but it's there. Yeah. A lot of 30 cals being used on the firebase.
A lot of 30 cals. There's a ANM2, the aircraft version of the 50 cal.
Yeah. It's nice.
Is in there.
No M60s, though.
I thought there were.
Was there?
I think there's some in the background, but you don't see any main characters, but there are a couple in the background.
Yeah,
I think was weird is John Wayne doesn't fire a shot the entire film.
No, he doesn't.
He just carries it round upside down a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's weird. It looks wrong on Wayne. It doesn't look right on Wayne for him to be shooting an M60.
No,
it doesn't look right.
It's because he's like man out of time, isn't he? It's weird.
Yeah.
And the only time he actually fires a gun is when he's on a weird clay range with an actual colonel from Fort Benning, and he has a shotgun, and he mimes firing at a clay. And he's like, why are you at a clay range? This is weird. This is a weird scene.
They just walk into them shooting at clays. It's bizarre,
and it looks like it's just a big PT field, not a clay range.
Yeah. It's odd. It's really odd. And I think we're not at this stage where Vietnam War movies have defined tropes either. So I think that's why some of this stuff's been omitted.
Yeah, you know what? I think this kind of begins to set up some tropes in a lot of
ways.
Some
of them.
It kind of establishes the firebase siege trope.
Yes, does do that.
A little bit. And, you know, speaking of tropes, I'm glad you mentioned that because I thought we'd start 2024 with a cliche trope count.
Have you done a cliche trope count? Wow, I didn't know this, folks. This is brand new. Wow.
So we've got Camp CO is killed a day before he goes home. The captain that they're going to replace is killed in a mortar.
I was one day left from retirement type stuff, but war movie version. Yeah.
Exactly. The lieutenant that's killed by the mortar round in the actual main climactic battle is the only remains of him are a smoking pair of boots.
Yeah.
Which is like something out of a cartoon.
Yeah, like Acme war movie.
There's multiple, and I love it, multiple uses of the Wilhelm scream throughout.
There is, it's great. Yeah,
there's at least three. And then finally, just to round out the trope count, John Wayne, the colonel he's replacing, and Aldo Ray are all way too old for the positions they're in.
Massively old. Like, oh gosh, more on that later. So I think maybe we're into favourite scenes.
Rob, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So I didn't mention it in the Ali Tally because I think there's more to it. So Muldoon, my favourite part of it is very early on in the movie, which kind of, you know, prefaces the fact that I don't enjoy the film. So Muldoon is giving a lecture series, I guess, to journalists on the actions of the Green Berets and what they're doing throughout the world. Sets the Green Berets up quite nicely, actually.
He's being Captain Exposition in that scene, isn't he?
He really, really is, yeah. So they're going into Vietnam and what the Americans are doing there. And it's clearly, for, you know, it's this is for the audience, really, to pump up the Americans.
If you haven't heard of the war that's going on in Vietnam, allow Aldo Ray to just explain it to you for 5 minutes.
If you've been living under a rock, then this is for you. So it's clunky in a way, and it feels really forced. But he explains domino theory, which is the theory of that if one nation falls to communism, the nation next to it will, then the nation next to it will. And it was this big, you know, red fear in the 50s and 60s that, you know, unless you take armed intervention against a communist country to quell it, then you'll lose an entire region to communism. But he shows that through weapons that are supplied to the Viet Cong.
I love it.
And it's really clunky, and I've screen captured the script here. So Beckwith goes, the journalist says, "That's very good, Sergeant, but there are still a lot of people who believe that this is simply a war between the Vietnamese people. It's their war. Let them handle it." Sergeant Muldoon, "Let them handle it, Mr. Beckwith." He points to some guns. Sergeant Muldoon says, "Captured weaponry." And the screen director, the direction is, Muldoon takes the weapons from the board. He names them and drops them on the table. As he talks, Sergeant Muldoon says, "From Red China, Chicom K-50, Chinese communist, SKS, Soviet-made carbine, Russian communist, ammunition, Czechoslovakian-made, Czech communist. No, sir, Mr. Beckwith, it doesn't take a lead weight to fall on me or hit me from one of these weapons to recognize that what's involved here is communist domination of the world." through three kind of spread out countries. Like it's clunky, and it's really forced, but I kind of respect that they do
try. John Wayne in the background with a big Cheshire Cat grin.
Tell
them about that domino theory. Yeah, tell them.
Explain domino theory, Aldo. Do it. It's really clunky.
Yeah, Pilgrim. Tell them all about that domino theory.
But I enjoyed that because I was like, I kind of like what a writer's done here. It's quite well written in its own way. And it does a good job as well, showing how, as I mentioned in the Ali Tally, how well equipped the Pavan and VC were, because I think that often gets overlooked in these movies anyway.
And again, weapons kind of fit into that earlier period of the war as well, quite well.
Mm. It's not handled fantastically, but it's there. You know, a lot of things in this movie are just there. They're just in there for their sake. So
yeah,
what's your favourite scene if you have one?
It's Sulu going out on the claymores. I think
it's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's George Takei on the claymores because he, you know, they actually there's a really great scene where they arrive at the camp, and it's a relocation camp. They're moving Montagnards away from, you know, VC control, etc. And that goes well for them. Basically, John Wayne arrives and he surveys the camp, and they show him all the various bits, and he's like, "You need to push that fire zone, that killing zone back. You need to add more cans to this fence. You need to triple the amount of claymores you've got set up." And he kind of like does a nice close up shot of a claymore in position.
Yeah, it's nice.
And it's like, and it's, you know, it comes into play later on with the kind of Takai's last stand, and he's inside a little bunker, and he just like hits a couple of the controls and lets off a couple of the claymores, and then he gets killed.
That's good. Yeah, he's the best character for me.
Yeah,
he has the most at stake, because guess what, he lives there.
And the script, he does kind of express that. And what I think is really weird about that scene is John Wayne's expression at the end of it. He looks literally uncomfortable with what the character has said to him.
Yeah.
Like, my home's in Hanoi. I can't go back until I've killed Buku VC or whatever he says.
Yeah, you know? Something like that.
And John Wayne just looks it doesn't have the look on his face that you would imagine
no.
the character would have had in that situation. It's a bit of a weird scene. And yeah. it undercuts Takai as well in a weird way.
The movie does it at every turn. Every time something is said that could be seen either way being pro or anti-war, it underlines itself with America number one rubbish, jingoistic
Leroy should have leaned in there and gone, John, can you just give me that scene again, but with actual like a normal reaction to
some kind of emotion. Said. Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? But no, you are right. Sulu is, not Sulu, sorry, you are right. George Takei is really good in it. Like, he's one of the saving graces of the movie. I wish he'd been in it more.
Him and I've forgotten the character's name. Doc,
yeah.
The medic sergeant. He's great in it too. I think his character is... his performance lifts the character. The character doesn't have a lot to do.
There's not a lot on the page, yeah. It reminded me a lot of Woody Strode, what he was given in the 60s and what he did with it in the
50s. That's a good comparison, actually.
You know, yeah. Really elevating kind of the role.
Give it some gravitas, doesn't he?
Yeah, really bringing something to it. But obviously, you know, being underused, like a lot of black actors were back then.
Yeah.
You know, Woody Strode being one of them and St. Jake's. So I think we're into final thoughts for this week. And I'll start because I've been wanting to say this line on the show for so long. I saved it and I'm probably paraphrasing it. But a listener once tweeted when we mentioned Green Berets once before. Mm-hmm. And I think it captures the essence of this movie so, so well. If you remember tweeting it, please let us know. So I'd love to congratulate you on it because you've summed it up better than I ever could. It's a 40s movie with a 50s cast filmed in the 60s.
Yeah.
Like this film just does not work for me. Like Ebert said, it's a Western. It feels like a Western. Mm. Like the attack on the firebase is so static. It's like an attack on a wagon train. And even
Via Alamo. That's what it is.
Via Alamo. Yeah. Really, really is.
And that's a third of the picture too, which is weird.
And
the film should have ended there.
It should, yeah. So I have a thing about this. So that the film there feels to be, because the first time I saw it, I turned off at that point because I had to go and do something else. And I thought that was the ending. So in my brain for the last few months, I'd be like, oh, well, that movie doesn't actually end on that bad of a jingoistic tone. So I assumed that the movie ends by having a sort of semi-decent message of saying, look how the VC fight, you know, we've been overwhelmed and, you know, the small band of South Vietnamese and this American Special Forces have been overwhelmed by an evil, you know, communist force or whatever. But this is why we're fighting the war to stop them doing this.
Yeah.
But no, the movie just goes and has a massive side quest of capturing a general that just feels so tacked on. It's like, why are we having a B plot now? You've not said anything about this the whole way through. And then you get another 40 minutes.
It's wild, isn't it? Because there's a scene where they take him to like a golf course or something at Fort Benning. And they're like, why are we out here? And it's him and the colonel he's replacing as the SF area commander.
It's beggar's belief.
And the South Vietnamese colonel. And he's like, well, it's super secret. And so secret, we haven't mentioned it in the film before.
We haven't even mentioned it before. Yeah.
And we're going to remember that general we mentioned like 30 minutes ago briefly in a scene that was like completely unnecessary in a bar. We're going to capture him.
It feels like a rewrite. It feels like they've had to add something on. Like maybe the original message of the ending has been lost.
It's interesting because in Michael Mann's book, there is a quote from Wayne where he says, I was trying to keep everyone happy and still keep my vision of what I wanted. But the studio wanted one thing and the men from the Defense Department wanted something else completely.
Right.
Let me tell you, it was said I got all the hardware and the real soldiers who were in the picture for free. I paid for everything that belonged to the Defense Department. But I still could only hire the hardware and soldiers if we changed things in the script. So a lot got changed. So that quote is really interesting to me. And then later mentions that the Department of Defense in the original script, the mission goes into North Vietnam to capture the general.
Oh, okay.
And the Department of Defense said, we wouldn't go into North Vietnam. You need to change that. And they changed it to the general is in South Vietnam.
We can't have people working out. We're sending LERP teams into Laos and Cambodia. We can't have that coming out yet, you know. And then, oh God, if they'd have done that. And then a few years later, there was the disastrous South Vietnamese-American invasion of Cambodia that went awfully wrong. Like, oh my God, it would have been life imitating art.
Talk about mission slip. Yeah.
I know. Wow. Wow. I can see them not wanting to have that, but wow. But yeah, I mean, you know, for me this week, the pacing's awful. There are so many scenes of little consequence. The action is bland. I can fully understand why it's universally panned. You know, it's not even a good John Wayne film.
No, like, it's not.
He just lumbers around and speaks in like these sort of, I wouldn't even say Shakespearean, but these sort of...
He sort of like proselytizes, doesn't he?
Yeah, proselytizing, that's the word I was looking for. But as this weird little pro-war NAM film released in the most contentious year probably of the Vietnam War, at home and in Vietnam itself, to a point, like, it's such an anomaly in terms of history and film and jingoism and everything. It's fascinating, but it's shit. Like, it's so weird.
No, I agree. Let me talk about some of the positives, and I'll hit the negatives as well. So, you know, there's some really well constructed bits. The helicopter attack on the MVA bridge, which they are, it doesn't say why they're building that bridge, but they're building that bridge.
They never go back to it, man.
And they attack the bridge. They destroy the bridge. That's a nice little scene.
Yeah.
There's great flying sequences throughout. And that kind of leans into the fact that the film is basically just one giant capability demo. And in defense terms, what that means is it's showing off all the capabilities of the US Armed Forces at the time. So you've got almost all the US Army's weaponry is on show. Techniques are shown. Equipment like Hueys, Chinooks, Spooky, Skylift, Starlight Scopes, the Combat Jump, all of the aircraft on that strip when they land. Like, half of that has got no business.
The only thing they didn't show was like the Brown Water Navy or the tanks or APCs or something. It's almost like we're just having like a brochure of like what we've got, and there's
nods to stuff. There's like nods to Hearts and Minds, where Doc is trying to help the locals and they're trying to move the Montanards around.
Look, fellas, everything that hasn't worked up to this point, like, you know, I'm surprised they didn't say about the reinforced, I can't remember its actual name, but they did a thing of reinforcing South Vietnamese compounds, reinforced, I forget the name. But like, I'm surprised they haven't mentioned that in there. Like, it feels like you're sometimes reading a Max SOG report.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's like, here's our counterparts, the South Vietnamese Army. They're really good. They are really good at what they're doing. And that might be the case, but the film really hammers home that they're really good. But I also like some of the more nuanced bits where it mentions that there's VC within George Takei's company. And you know, Beckwith says, there's a great little scene where Beckwith says, they're really that close. You know, they send out a patrol. And Takei like tends to him and says, there's VC in my platoon. And Beckwith's just like, what?
Not wrong. Yeah. You know.
And there's bits of that come up later on, obviously. But yeah, for all the few good points, there's a lot going on. John Wayne cannot direct a tight film.
He can't, because he's directing movies that he was in when he was 30.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, it's all he knows.
It doesn't help that there's two other directors working on this. The pace is way off.
Yeah.
The kind of like...
It's a slog.
It ambles at the beginning. It picks up for the actual in-country combat sequence. And then they go off on a weird tangent. It's like over an hour before anything happens.
And then they just start a B-plot. And I'm sitting there like, the credits should be bloody rolling.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
It's 144 minutes long. Sorry, 141 minutes long. And it could be a tight 120.
Yeah. Yeah.
If someone had reined it in.
And they wouldn't. We wouldn't want to rein John Wayne in, would you?
No.
You wouldn't have that job.
It's weird because it does, like I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but it does introduce all these, you know, some of the the key tropes of Vietnam films. And you kind of hinted at it earlier, where you talked about it in terms of it being a cowboy film, and it does feel like he's fighting savages. That's what it feels like, because there's no humanity given to the enemy.
We're not at Hamburger Hill, you know, respect your enemy speech, because you know, and the Charlie calling up to the line with the fake RPG to show how you know, how good the VC are, you know, because they, because at this point, obviously the film's trying to show you that they're a bad enemy force, but no, they're bloody not. You know, like every, you know, you read an action report about Vietnam, every time the VC would give the US a bloody nose or the Aussies a bloody nose, and it would only be through sheer firepower and air power support that the VC would get beaten back. You know, there's a reason the VC don't openly fight the American and Australians in the Vietnam War if they can help it, because they know war materiel power, they don't have it.
Yeah.
But what they do have...
They knew their strengths.
Exactly. They know their strengths. So, but every time that the VC were eventually drawn into a pitched battle, yes, they get a bloody nose, but they give a bloody nose back. And I don't think the movie kind of gets that, but it doesn't get it enough.
Yeah, it undermines it with the spooky when. So we get a fairly good set piece. It's about 20 minutes long. It's quite nuanced. It's a little bit clunky in places with the choreography of when elements are moving up and stuff. I thought the interesting thing there was the inclusion of the foo gas explosions and stuff. Yeah. That was kind of cool. Also, just remembered, but we've got to mention that the model work is awful.
Horrific.
The helicopter that John Wayne's in when it gets shot down during that sequence, model work on it looks terrible.
It's bad.
Terrible.
It's bad.
And also the bit where they're in the tower and the tower falls, and it's quite clearly dummies that are just like rattling around inside.
And
the bit
where they light up the barbed wire, and there's loads of dummies in it, and then they rake the dummies with machine gun fire.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's just so clunky. Mm. You know, audiences at that time deserve more than that.
I did think actually, once the helicopter had crashed and the door gunner rolls out on fire.
Yeah,
that was quite a shocking scene. I thought that was fairly well done. I hated the Beckwith character. Hated it.
He's just there, and then he's not.
He is literally just there for John Wayne to talk at.
Yeah. He's the anti-war movement personified.
He is. Like literally, he's a caricature. It's dire. John Wayne's having to prove him wrong the hard way. That's what the film is, basically. If you wanted a synopsis of the film.
But yet, if he actually did any research into the era, the journalists were not even having to prove how ineffective and how badly the war was going. They know it's a shit show. You know, and the American, this is the problem with this movie. By this point, the American viewing public knew. They knew it wasn't going well out there. In terms of being able to win it, a viable strategy of what do you do? It becomes like an Afghanistan situation. Yes, you could subdue the NVA and the PAVN. You could do it, but it would take millions and millions of defense spend, and it would take hundreds of thousands of manpower. And even then, you're not going to have a happy medium in the country. You're just going to have an armed occupation keeping everything at bay. I just think the movie is just an affront to even trying to begin. And even in like 68, we're 6 years into the war at this point, even longer if you count American involvement in the 50s, etc. You know, it's just such a weird thing. It's as I said, it's this anomaly. It's just so weird.
And I could forgive it a lot of things, but if it had just given its audience a bit of credit. Because we get that terrible, completely detached B plot that comes in the last act of the film. And John Wayne is the last person I would send on a covert high value mission, by the way. He just did not look the commando part that you would not send 55, 60 year old John Wayne to go and
runs everywhere as well.
He does. And I don't know whether you noticed, but when he does the loop on the carabiner when he's about to abseil down the building, he really does not do that loop very well. Like
he doesn't.
If he'd actually like tried to abseil with the loop he puts on that carabiner, he'd just
face blown it. Yeah.
But the point I was going to make is Peterson's death is the point in the film where you know they just did not give a shit about what the audience thought or had any you know self-awareness. His death is so fucking stupid. They're exfilling, they're walking back to the rendezvous.
Yeah.
He's a skilled veteran who has been on multiple tours in Vietnam. He's a Green Beret, and then he steps in a noose, and it's like a cartoon bullshit where he gets pulled, and they're like, "Oh no, no!" And he gets pulled, and then whipped onto what looks like a giant framework of just spikes,
like which a human mouse trap.
The VC were well known for making big mattress spikes, weren't they?
Mm.
Like, punchy sticks in a hole and stuff.
Yeah,
but come on. He's up there impaled, and they're like, "Oh no, what a shame!" And then they just walk off. And that's also Wayne can have that stupid little scene with Hamchuk where Hamchuk's like going, Peterson, and he's running around doing the terrible
Don't
accent.
Don't get me started on Hamchuk.
Hamchuk is a terrible character.
Well, he's South
obvious.
Vietnam. He's South Vietnam in Persified.
Yeah.
Because there's a line I think
We're
Aldo.
We're doing this for you.
Yeah.
What is
line,
this for, Hamchuk?
That fucking line. I'm like, oh my God, it's the most ham-fisted piece of exposition I've ever heard. I was like, you're all they have. I'm like, oh my God.
Do you know what? My actual, my favorite scene is when Kowalski takes on 4BC and kills one by impaling him on a tree.
Yeah, it's just, oh God.
That is actually my favorite scene. That man has never been introduced other than he's mentioned like briefly.
Wild.
I don't think
we've ever had someone mention their favorite scene at the sheer end of the pod.
Well, 2024, it's a wild ride.
It's the
essentially
wrap in, folks.
For some reason, 4VC attack him with machetes and it's hand to hand. He loses his rifle. Oh no, what's he going to do? Oh, I'll just impale a dude on a tree.
Yeah. Well,
and he does.
Why wouldn't you?
And
you
that also kind of sums up this film.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So I think there we go. I think that we've exhausted our Green Beret chat there with a chap being impaled on a tree. So, you know, as he was hung up, we'll hang up our thoughts this week. What a segue, Matt. Come on.
You smashed that like the Mattel against the tree.
I did. Yeah. That was as ham-fisted as this film's writing. So, thanks very much for joining us. It's 2024. We've got an action-packed year ahead of us on Fighting on Film. If you're looking forward to Masters of the Air, please do join us for our specials that are coming out very, very soon, right after this episode, a couple of days. I think episode 1 and 2 are dropping on Apple TV. So come and listen to us for those.
All the episodes are going to drop on the same day of release as the actual show. So you can watch the show, listen to the episode, or listen to the episode, watch the show. It's up to you.
And then coming up next week after this episode, we have the Patreon pick, which, if you're still listening, is Murphy's War, the Peter O'Toole film from 1971.
And if you'd like to get involved and vote for next month's Patreon pick, do please become a Patreon, support the show. You can get the opportunity to ask guaranteed questions to guests. Support us and also, as we say, vote for the Patreon pick, which is every month.
Yeah, exactly. Please do help keep the mics on. And all is left to say, thanks for listening. Join us again next week for more war movie chat. Bye bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Have fun in Vegas, Matt.
Thanks. I'll try.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.